enamorarte, tengo el truco, qué lindo te queda en esa Hugo.
Y yo para enamorarte, tengo el truquito, qué rico tú hueles a hipoclorito.
Mami, para enamorarte, tengo el truco, qué lindo te queda en esa Hugo.
Y yo para enamorarte, tengo el truquito, qué rico tú hueles a hipoclorito.
Estoy loco que se acabe el aislamiento, bate bien duro. Como cemento, loco que se acabe la cuarentena, cógela en grande contigo, nena. Estoy loco que se acabe el aislamiento, bájate bien duro. Como cemento, loco que se acabe la cuarentena, pa' cogerla en grande contigo, nena. Mami, pa' enamorarte, tengo el truco, qué lindo te queda en esa Hugo.
Y yo pa' enamorarte, tengo el truquito, qué rico tú hueles a hipoclorito.
Mami, pa' enamorarte, tengo el truco, qué lindo te queda en esa Hugo.
Sorry. Now I can welcome you all to a board scientist under the shower. I forgot to turn on the volume. Sorry about that. So we start with a Cuban song, which might remind you of some special exotic atmosphere, although right now a little bit less touristy, because of course of this huge pandemia due to this enemy we all have around the world. And we're actually gonna talk, hopefully it was a nice introduction for our tonight guest. Has already been a guest in one previous show. Welcome to Agustin Lage Castellanos. Hi, Agustin, directly from Cuba, from Havana, Cuba. Hi, Agustin.
How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. How are you doing? I mean, pretty good. I mean, in the limit of the moment we are living in.
Oh, we're good. We're good. Yeah.
Okay. Can you probably, if you can manage to increase a little bit the volume of the microphone? I mean, I listen to you, but probably if... do you listen me well?
I listen you well, yes. I listen you well. I'm trying to increase my volume. It's almost at the maximum.
No, but it's fine. It probably... No. I just increase... probably was my fault. Just have to increase the volume. How are you doing? I already asked you. First of all... The people already should know you because once again you've been guest already. But can you briefly introduce yourself? You are a colleague, a neuroscientist, but you are a mathematician. You're a bit everything, so that's why I always like to have you as a guest.
You are overestimating my capabilities.
No, I'm not. You are underestimating your capabilities.
Well, part of the year I work in Maastricht, at Maastricht University. There is where I met Francesco first time. And
long time ago, actually.
Yeah, very long time ago. And yeah, it's been maybe 8 years ago or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably more even.
And many others Italians.
Yes. Unfortunately.
Part of the neuroscience community.
Yeah, we all.
My life in Maastricht is surrounded by Italians, researchers.
You actually speak Italian very well.
I speak kind of, it's an invention, it's not really Italian. but enough for you to understand me. And of course also enjoying the nice dinners they prepare all the time. But I keep a strong link with my country and keep working here part of the year and also trying to contribute to scientific research here. And now I'm here to help the family and also the country in this challenge that we are facing.
Yeah, because actually when I was thinking about this show, I was thinking, I mean, who can I invite that is... that we European actually who lives in a country we European just do not know what is going on, because actually we know very well what is going on in Europe. We know perfectly well, unfortunately, what is going on in US, but we don't know what the situation is anywhere else. And actually Cuba is a very always been a very peculiar, beautiful island, but also very peculiar in the procedure you guys use and the approach you use in a lot of fields of science, economy. So I was curious, really, being you there.
Yeah, well, I
was curious.
I can comment superficially what is happening here. We are trying to face the problem with very limited resources in terms of money, and most of the things we need to are expensive. Then we are trying to, our approach is basic, like social for the disease, and we have like several levels of attacks that we are taking to the problem. The first level, we have like we are visiting every house like one time per day by students and social workers, just for searching people who can show some symptoms of the disease.
So let me understand. So you guys, every family, every apartment house is visited every single day.
Yeah, that's the idea. That's the idea. I cannot tell you it's 100% the case, but maybe it's 90% of the people are getting visited every day. And in particular, the people with higher risk, they get more attention. And in this way, we can like distribute better the tests we have, because we are concentrating the tests on those people showing some symptoms or people being at higher risk. And then up to now, seems that it's working pretty well, because the number of cases is growing linearly. We didn't go to the exponential stage of the epidemic, and then...
So never?
No, never up to now. No. Up to now, all the increase was a linear increase. And
but it's pretty unique, Agustin, isn't it?
I think that for the countries that react fast, they also manage. I think that... I have been checking data of other countries, and there are some countries in Asia that managed to keep the situation in control, or to mitigate the peak very fast, as New Zealand, for example. I was checking New Zealand, and they had a peak, but they went very fast to and a small number of cases.
Okay. And so you are managing to containing the contagion. So how many... More or less, how many contagion you have?
We are having per day between 20 and 50 new cases.
Oh, it's almost known.
Very well. The population in the country is 11 million.
It's huge.
Being a country,
yeah,
it's a big country in terms of number of people, and the cities are very crowded. It is the population density here in Havana is big, and. Up to now, the situation looks under control, but in the other side, we have to impose strict measures that, and we are paying a big economical cost on this, because as many people know, we depend on tourists coming, and now we don't have more tourists coming, and also Cubans that are living abroad cannot travel now to the country, because there are not many flights coming, and then the economical crisis is getting worse. But in other hand, the government is trying to manage to distribute the resources we have to the people that are in big need of them.
So you're managing to contain the contagion, but the at the price of big economical crisis.
Yeah, we have some economical troubles before. Some of them are related with the embargo, and some of them are also related with the inefficiency of our system. We cannot, embargo is not the only reason.
But the embargo, even in such a critical situation, is not being more lenient?
No. I think that the people in US, they don't care about that. And in this moment, they care less. And yeah, everything keeps running the same. I think that maybe it's getting worse because the companies are being more careful to don't violate anything related with that can become harmful for them in the future. Then if they need to sell something to Cuba, they will check twice now if this is going to affect the relation with the United States in the future.
Wow. What about the because I also know that a lot of relatives are abroad, so they are not allowed to come to Cuba. What is also the situation? Well, because I mean, the Cuban population is also very numerous outside Cuba as well.
Yeah, we had a huge number of people immigrating to living abroad. Particularly, we have a huge community in Florida and also in Spain. And traditionally, these people contribute to the economy of the country, supporting their families. But also in these two countries, in US and Spain, they are facing a big crisis in terms of the disease. Then these resources we were getting to the Cuban economy, I think that they are not coming anymore.
Then, so there's not even
if we manage to control the disease, we probably we will face a very difficult economic situation in the next year. We already see some shortage of resources, and we have been making waiting lines and for buying food, and everything is well organized, but getting some basic products is becoming not very easy.
So, yeah.
But the situation is stable in terms of there is no, it's a stability in this situation. Everything is under control.
The thing that amazed me.
There is no panic in people up to now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And still, the thing that, so it's very interesting, the fact that the situation is like you describe it, not very easy to work with, but you still send medical doctors everywhere. I mean, at least I know that there was this big news few weeks ago about Cuban medical doctor in Italy, which is something actually which point out the generosity of your people.
This is an old tradition in Cuban politics. It's coming from, I think it's old, it's from maybe it's coming from the 70s. And in after yeah, in the last 20 years really increased the number of doctors that we were sending abroad at the beginning in Latin America and Africa. We sent a good team of doctors to fight in the Ebola in Africa a few years ago. Interesting, in collaboration with US, because at this time Obama was in the government, and this was one of the initial points where Cuba and US start to communicating about how to solve the problem of the Ebola in Africa. And then US was giving some resources and we were sending people. Then we have some experience with this situation of crises and disasters and earthquakes, hurricanes, which are very frequent here. And then our doctors are trained in working with very little amount of resources. They don't work in very sophisticated hospitals. They work with the most basic facilities. And in these conditions, they manage to do some quite good job.
Yeah, because I mean, I know that you have
I think that many governments ask for help, and the Cuban government send teams to many different countries. In Europe, I know that there are people in Italy, in the north, in two places, in Crema and in Piemonte. I know that there are people in Spain, in the Basque country, I think. There are people in Andorra, and there is another team in Germany.
Oh, wow. I actually didn't know. Of course, I knew only about the one that to that came to Italy, but I didn't know that there were, I mean, in several European countries. That's, I mean, I also know because I've been a few times in Cuba, and every time there were people from Europe going to Cuba for some cure about cancer. So you have a long tradition of generosity in terms of medical help, but also in terms of medical expertise in general.
Yes, this is true, but it's also true that the concepts that they use for treating these kind of problems are kind of different to the country, to the concepts, the approach they use in more developed countries. Then we have
you use the brain more.
Very social concept of medicine, like primary attention in the neighborhoods here is very important. They keep watching at people from the very beginning, and this works. This works for childhood care, child mortality. All this is very important, that you have the network of attention goes very deep in society.
So everyone is taking care, let's say, literally.
Yeah, in other hands, we really need ventilators and sophisticated machines that we don't have here, and it's not easy that to buy, and it's not easy to find them and to find how to arrive to the country. Then is we also have big limitations now, and it's also true that sometimes medical doctors also emigrate to more developed countries. Then there are many aspects of this problem. It's complicated.
Before, you said something that attracted my attention. So you said that I'm here, yeah, because I spent some time of the year in Cuba. But so once I came, I'm helping out. So I wanted to ask you something more general. So are Cuban doctors or Cuban mathematicians or physicians physicist, thank you, helping with the COVID 19?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think that the government put everybody that can contribute to the problem is working on the problem now. From their own perspective, we have, like, of course, the medical doctors are working from the hospitals, but we have, like, researchers, have a big network of research institutes and biotechnology industries working on how to use the products we have, how to combine these products for the treatment of the disease. And also we have teams making research in trying to produce new products, but this will be more long-term. But this is in one hand. In other hand, we have the people in the university that they are approaching more from the computer science perspective of the problem, like trying to make predictions about how the disease is going to behave in the country, and also how to measure the impact of the restrictions that we are taking in terms of movement and controlling how the people connect with other people, our social distancing. We have the physicists working in that, the mathematicians working in that. And we have regular meetings every week. Also, there are people that were not connected with these institutions that wanted to join, and they are participating. Like people who were graduated from mathematics and physics, they are also trying to help. And I think it's a very good exercise for integration, and the people feel that they are useful. Working in this way.
That's interesting. Do you think so? Are there already some concrete result of this extensive collaboration in the country? So there is some hope that we reach European can reach. I mean, now unfortunately the people cannot look at me, but I'm doing this. This sign to say that it's not.
Well, really I think that part of the success is due to organization. Then we are implementing here some measures that I don't know if other countries will be able to implement, because it requires like a very dense social tissue, and that the people, everybody gets connected with what should be done, and the people follow the instruction, and you have people controlling everywhere. And this is part of the success. But you were asking more in terms of treatment, no?
Yeah.
Yes. I know that they are trying free Cuban medicines that were invented here, and for the treatment of the critical care. One is related with inflammation, because part of the hypothesis is that there is a collapse of the collapse of the lungs is coming from an inflammatory response. It's not exactly because of the virus, it's a very strong inflammatory response because of the immune system.
So it's treating the symptom, let's say, of the virus.
It's treating, the idea is that maybe the people is dying because the inflammation is so intense that you cannot use your lungs anymore, you are not functional.
So at the valley of the problem.
You had some immunodepress the patient a little bit, and you get some improvement because the reaction to the disease is a bit less strong, and then maybe you get more time. But with this idea, it's very important the timing when you start using this, because you maybe at the beginning of the disease, maybe you need the patient to be to be very immune competent. No, you don't want to immunodepress the patient. This is one approach. There are two other approaches that are to boost the antiviral response. There are two Cuban products that were designed for that, and we are trying to combine them. The doctors in the intensive care seems very positive about the results, but still, as you say, the sample we have is very small because the number of patients is not that big, and it's not like a control study. We don't have control cases and cases where that are taking the disease. They're taking the medicine. We are distributing the medicine to everybody.
Okay. And
for this, will be required more like a control study, like a clinical trial. We are not doing a clinical trial.
So for control, for the people that don't know what a control is, are people that are not affected by this case, by the virus, and a sample population that is needed to see whether there is a significant effect of, in this case, of those antivirals.
We are very positive in general.
Okay, but finally, a positive somehow look into the future. So, last question, Agustin, you were super helpful, and I thank you very much. I first thank you very much to be a guest of tonight's.
My pleasure, man. You know.
What about the future, indeed? So, how do you see it? Where do you see? But this is just. I mean, what is your feeling? I don't want anything scientific or anything.
The future is very uncertain. I think will be a huge challenge for everybody, but also for us, because we don't have resources here to keep running the economy in isolation. We need to open the country to the world again. And this is going to be very difficult in the actual situation. Because, for example, energy, we depend on buying, we need to buy energy to our country. Then for this, we need to export some products. And our main income was tourism, is not coming anymore. We were exporting some medical service before, but I don't think that this was enough for keeping the country running. Then we need to stimulate local agriculture again. That this was always part of the speech, but never really worked very well.
What do you mean exactly, the local? So is it not one of the main product or one of the main field sustaining the Cuban economy, agriculture? Or has been lately a bit...
Never. We tried to make it work, but up to now, we have to import a lot of food, like rice,
even being, poured rice.
Yeah, we import a lot of rice from Asia and Brazil. Yes. And now we need to find a way to produce ourselves.
Agustin, I thank you once again. So what I can say in terms of a positive side into the future is that as soon as this thing is finishing, the first country I'm going to visit is Cuba, just to help your guys out, who are very generous with us, who are very competent, and I'm sure that you're going to find a solution, a medical solution for that. So
I meet you before in the Netherlands for eating a good pasta.
Ah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you will be definitely my guest in my new place, actually.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thank you. Bye.
Ci vediamo presto.
Ci vediamo. Ciao, bello. Ciao, ciao.
Ciao.
So now I'm going to invite another colleague of mine. It's called Rajat. He's also been, my guest a couple of times in my radio show. But before that, I'm gonna enjoy, and hopefully you're gonna enjoy with me this song from Galeffi, which is also once again is an Italian artist, and once again is a wish of a good luck for the future, because it's called Sette Belle. Sette Bello is a in Italian cards is a very good card, the card that bring a lot of luck. So please enjoy Sette Bello from Galeffi.
Verba nella testa, ma quasi mai la soluzione. E non so darmi una risposta, solo puntini di sospensione. Sono bravissimo ad aver paura, sono bravissimo con la sfortuna. E quando scende la notte mi manca l'ossigeno. Come un fuoco d'artificio è solo una stella col guinzaglio. Nella testa, Michelangelo nel cuore, un sette bello sulle labbra, ma quanto è bello immaginare Milano, perché non ti compri il mare, mentre Roma ormai si fa ammazzare, ha una medaglia al dolore che non passa mai, però come un fuoco d'artificio. D'artificio è solo una stella col guinzaglio. Io non so.
Eccolo, yeah, it's here. Okay, hi Rajat, or Rajat. Are you doing Rajat?
Very good.
To be with us. You can, yeah, this will be an audio, of course, it will be in the radio, but I mean, we can look at each other. So Agustin, who was my previous guest, is still here because he wants to listen to you.
Yes, sir.
So if you're fine. And I mean, Agustin, if you want to intervene, Rajat is those people that knows everything, a bit like you. So you have a lot in common. So probably I can even leave you guys talking. Probably will be much more interesting. Hi, Rajat. So Rajat has been twice guest of The Bold Scientist Under the Shower. He's an astrophysicist, but also a neuroscientist. Now he's becoming an entrepreneur. He's going to be very rich. And I mean, I want to be ending my description of Rajat. If you want to briefly say something about you.
Yeah, so I'm currently officially an assistant professor at the Amsterdam University Medical Center, and that's most of my time goes on that. And for the rest of the time, I work for a startup, and also launched my own startup, for which I'll be dedicating most of my time in the coming future.
Exactly. That's when the money are coming. Ding, 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 ding.
all my work is in and around the use of artificial intelligence for different domains, disciplines, problems.
Yeah, we discussed indeed. We discussed indeed about artificial intelligence last time that I had you as guest. Rajat, what about this? What is your perspective? We had a Cuban perspective with our previous guest, and he told us a lot of interesting things. And actually, there is one thing, one of the aspects that he pointed out, who is related to collaboration, that I probably I'm going to also ask you and about your experience. So with you, I want to probably approach it from another perspective. So do you think there are some positive sides? I mean, it might sound a bit cynical or paradoxical, but do you think there's some positive side? I mean, did you experience some positive side in this period?
I think. A lot of the aspects were quite positive from my perspective.
Okay, right? You're probably one of the few.
So, I mean,
together with me.
Exactly. I'm one of those people who try to find what, you know, how some crisis like this could be converted to something which is interesting or which is beneficial to all of us, right? So before I talk about specific things, I mean, in general, I think you realize that this crisis brought something really kind of fascinating, but kind of, in this case, a bit depressing about the way the EU works, right? Because we saw that because the healthcare system is so different and disparate, what happened was there was no real collaboration at all.
Absolutely.
So when things started off in Italy and everybody wash their hands. They say, this is Italy's problem. They didn't take care of this properly, blah, blah, blah. Instead of trying to focus and trying to fix things. And everything, like, because there is no common sort of medical system across Europe, when people came from Italy to Holland, for example, nobody could track them. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it was funny that the borders are open, the trade is open, everything is open, so people can go around, but the healthcare system is closed, pretty much. Okay? So that sort of brought up this, because otherwise this problem could have been solved sort of much more easily than if things were more transparent. Also in terms of funds and so in terms of treatment protocols. This is what
protocols. So yeah, the crazy thing is that there were not common protocols. I mean, what the health organization is doing. I mean, what actually is doing if there are not common worldwide protocols about this?
So World Health Organization cannot dictate what each country does, but they have provided us with guidelines, right? And many, many countries, unfortunately, were too late to adopt those guidelines because those guidelines were a bit scary to everybody, right? Because they said social distancing, keep things locked down, everybody wear masks. Nobody listened to them until it was too late, right? So these are, and in Europe, mostly the issue was about good collaboration. Nobody collaborated well at all.
Absolutely.
So that was kind of, so in the positive
those are the depressive side.
Yeah, but at the same time, it also brings up an interesting question, right? So this has put strain on the system so much that people have started to rethink whether this is the right thing or actually.
Absolutely.
And that's where sort of I start seeing the positive side is now, just for this COVID-19, we saw that all the European countries are much more easily or willing to share data. Okay, so suddenly there was not only like, and if you're talking about very sensitive data, right? Clinical data and so on. Of course, it's a bit tricky, but they managed to do this relatively quickly compared to European times, if you wish, to do this. So that was nice. On top of that, we saw how the scientists were all excited to work together on this problem. So there was no borders at all. And this was not only across Europe, but almost the entire world. So we had discussions from people from the US, Canada, Japan, and so on and so forth. That was very interesting to see.
Now, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about, but I mean, you anticipated me because Agustin from Cuba told me that over there, everyone is collaborating from any field and they're working together to solve this problem. I mean, whatever field they normally work. Yeah. So I was wondering whether you experience the same being working in the hospital.
Yeah. I mean, so not only in the hospital but also from the startup and so on. Mm. Whatever we were doing, we just stopped doing that, and basically focused on doing COVID-19 projects. Okay, and this was done officially in the sense that from the top down, like for example, the University of Amsterdam provided special extensions for PhD students and so on who are working on COVID-19 projects. So I said, okay, if you're working on this project for 3 months, don't worry about your PhD. It'll be extended for 3 months, we'll pay for it.
Oh, wow.
Right? So, and people who are not really into medicine and so on just stopped because they have the experience in machine learning, for example, and they collaborated with the rest and made this happen. It's quite fascinating.
So do you think so according to what you explained, it's not necessarily a profit-related kind of...
Not at all. Not at all.
It's not driven.
I mean, none of the... it's not about the profit, right? It's we are like non-commercial entities, all of us, like the university, the hospital, and so on. And what I'm saying is even the commercial people, they didn't see any profit in this, right? Like getting some of their employees to work on this project. It was all about trying to create some new innovations that could be very impactful. So in that sense, I saw a coming together of very different kinds of people, very different nationalities, very different like working cultures, all becoming really open to solve this problem. That was very nice.
Nice. That's something that really surprised me because I would have expected more from some country like indeed Cuba. But I wasn't expecting the same type of behavior in a kind of more individualistic society like the one we're living in, but mostly not in a kind of this not profitable way. So this open some hope in general. Also for the future, Rajat. So this might also be a sort of learning experience for the future, for collaborating, for sharing, actually.
I mean, I mean, the only worry I have is like the short-term memory of the humankind.
Right? Yeah, that's
true. So in this particular, so in both senses, like I'll give you two examples. One is in this particular case, we saw that openly collaborating accelerates science, even in this world, where all the connectivity is there and so on, accelerates science by an order of magnitude, okay? So somebody makes a code for part A, somebody does it for another reason, somebody integrates this code, and suddenly, within like a few weeks, you have sort of a sophisticated, accomplished framework to tackle some of the most complicated questions. If one team was doing it, or they had to establish like collaborations in the old way, they would have taken months to do this, right? So it just shows that if you're really open, but the problem is, of course, the society now is built in such a way that if you don't have paper, citation, blah, 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 you have problems. In this case, nobody cared about it. It was almost like a utopian world, right? And you just see that mankind gains, okay? Not a particular group, but the humankind itself benefits. But how can you translate that to a norm? Now, that is a challenging question to answer.
The $1 million question.
$1 million question, exactly.
$1 million. What is gonna how? So now we are talking. So normally we had the last couple of show, the one you were guest live. Yeah. So now we're doing it in two different countries, very far away from each other. It works pretty well, actually. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether the audio at the end will be definitely worse than the one in the radio, but can be this become a norm, actually, in terms of communication, conferences, in the science world? Can this become a norm? Also, in terms of... Because I guess that this might have a lot of good, positive consequences.
Yeah, that's interesting you brought it up, because like last week, from the University of Amsterdam, we organized an international workshop. Okay, there were like 10 speakers for a day. So initially, it was not meant to be an e-workshop, if you wish, right? It was supposed to be a proper physical workshop.
Okay. Physical now, in the sense that, I mean, the real
power come, press. Everybody come here, right?
Okay.
But just think about it. It was just a one-day workshop, and there were 10 people who were supposed to give a talk, right? 10 people. And the 10 people pretty much came from, let's say, six different countries. Then all of them would have had to fly in to Amsterdam to give a 45-minute talk, have a few discussions, all this for one day. And then go, just imagine like the carbon footprint of just that one day workshop. It's incredible. Okay. Yeah. But now here, there's also many aspects to this. We organized the workshop completely online, and it was pretty awesome, because all the speakers could just give their talk from their backyard. Perfectly chill, wherever they were, and no jet lag for them, because they just had to get up and give a talk. At the same time, the softwares, the kind of Zoom thing that we're using, have been already in this very short time developed to handle kind of a conference workshop kind of environment. Okay, so we had like special poster sessions, breakout rooms, something like, in the form of Slack and other kind of communication frameworks that are out there. they just did that, and it was pretty awesome. Like, you don't have to stand there and just repeat what your poster is about 100 times.
It's true.
Yeah, it's true. You just nicely record what you want to say, and you can take it many times until you get it perfectly right. And then you put it up in the poster room, the virtual poster room. And then people come in there, they look at your poster, they hear you, and if they're interested, they ring a bell. And you're like, okay, these guys are interested.
Yeah.
And then you go and talk about the relevant stuff. Okay, so you can get right to the point.
If it doesn't ring a bell, you keep being in the terrace.
Exactly.
Sunbathing.
Exactly. And whenever you hear a ring, go back. You know, this is quite...
The ring.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think also the speakers enjoyed it. Because, you know, usually after somebody's talk, you have like, you know how it is in these conferences, right?
Yeah. Some,
the big guy gives a talk, and then you have like two or three questions somebody can ask. So here, the person is happily sitting at home or whatever, wherever he is, and he finishes his talk, and then he answers. You can raise your hand and stuff virtually, right? So he answers a few questions, and then since he's off, what other people can do is to send him like questions, and because he's free and he's sitting at home, he's happy to sit and answer many more questions in much more detail.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a much more interactive. So it's funny, in virtually it becomes much more interactive.
And actually, I mean, now that I'm thinking about, in principle, you can look at two different workshops at the same time, while you cannot be obviously in two places.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, like some of these big conferences have these many parallel sessions, right?
Yeah.
And you cannot go to...
Exactly.
So in this case, you can just say, okay...
Unless like, you're God, but I mean, probably not every one of us is.
just a few of us are. Yeah.
Rajat, you are Indian.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Indian origin. So as I asked... But you're not in India now, you're in Amsterdam. Yeah. But as I asked, so I like to cover the whole world. I'm in Rome, you're in Amsterdam,
right.
I was in Cuba. So how are your relatives in India? So how is the situation there?
The situation there, like every question in India, is what we call a conditional question. In the sense that, in my case, if you belong to a particular strata of the socioeconomic class, you're fine. If you're in the wrong part of that, you're pretty much screwed. Okay, this is essentially what's happening in India. If you are middle class, upper middle class, or higher, you're pretty much fine. If you are the lower middle class or lower than that, then
you're screwed.
Mostly because a large fraction of the, especially the migrant workers, they are all, as you say, ghost workers, right? They are not paid on paper. They are daily wage workers that get money every day. And when this stops, when everything, the economy stops, they don't have anything to fall back on.
Yeah, exactly. They can not even claim to the government because they cannot know their...
In fact,
yeah, that's also a big issue in Italy, actually. Yeah,
in the south, right? Especially.
Yeah.
So many of them had to walk like 500 kilometers just to get back home.
Yeah.
Because the whole country was locked down. It was crazy.
I actually was amazed, probably the most amazing negatively, in the negative sense, I saw during this period is this massive amount
migration.
Of people. Gathering at the bus station.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly where it was that. But this is pretty symbolic of the situation you were describing and how out of control and sometimes. Yeah.
It's extremely difficult because given the size of the country and these kind of problems that I just mentioned, even just educating the people, right? Because telling them that there's, for them, it's like, what are you talking about? You're doing all this because of a flu,
Education plays a role.
Yeah.
Rajat, the last question, if you can answer in 1 minute, then we can leave the place to your beautiful half, Teresa, which gonna tell us about her in 5 minutes if she can, because unfortunately we're a bit late.
Yeah,
well, you can already leave if you want to already leave, because I want to talk about your project, but we'll have time to talk about that.
Absolutely.
Just because Rajat has a project that is leading in the hospital about COVID-19. It's a management app, but we will have time to talk about that and also to see the result about that. Hi, Teresa De Santis was already. It was also a colleague of mine. We were colleagues when we worked at NIL, Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience. Now she's doing something else, Teresa.
Yes, so...
We have, just for you to know, we have 5 minutes, unfortunately. Okay. So,
I get the challenge.
Yes.
So I'm currently working in an NGO, which is called Pharma Access. Mm-hmm. Pharma Access stands for Access to Pharma. Okay. It was founded by one of the pioneers that challenged the status quo back in the 80s about the distribution of antiretroviral therapy in the African population.
Okay.
From there, we carried on his work and we extended also to other patient population like mother and child care and non-communicable disease. Currently, I take care of the patient engagement and the research related to mother and child care in Kenya and Tanzania.
Oh, nice.
Bringing back this to our COVID-19 discussion, what we can see so far, nevertheless, the outbreak there started just a bit delayed compared to the other countries, is that...
So there are also there are some cases there as well.
Yes, so if we refer to Kenya, around 300. In Tanzania, a bit less.
Not so many, though.
Not so many, but there we could talk a bit more. The measurement bias, but also the distribution of the population across the country and also across areas that are more or less reachable. So since we started there, like, 2 weeks ago, three now, I think the full-fledged still has to come. And as reconnecting to what Rajat was saying, what we see there mainly, allow me to premit that there has not been a lockdown there because it's not feasible. Collecting 80% of the population, lives on daily wages. And so lockdown is not an option, as well as most of the time social distancing and frequent hand hygiene is a commodity that not everyone has access to.
Yeah.
And in the special field related to the field of mother and child care, what we see so far is that the mortality, which I have to permit that is one of the highest mortality in sub-Saharan Africa for mother and child care. It seems already to have a slow increase because there is no lockdown, but there is a curfew. There is this curfew between 7 in the evening and 5 in the morning. No one can move or go anywhere. Sometimes mothers that are about to deliver don't manage to reach in time the hospital, or they don't know they can reach the hospital.
Oh.
Nevertheless, they curfew. And sometimes it's too late. So we are trying to put together intervention to help these kind of mothers.
To let them be aware of the fact that it's more important to have information about their status.
Exactly. So be aware that they can go out. Be aware that they can find a transportation mean. But also talking with the facilities, making sure that there are ambulances that are not that are available, not for other use, and they can reach the mothers that are more complication, but at the same time going to donors to collect funds for which we are able to pay for extra bed nights in case mothers can be admitted at the hospital in early labor time instead of later on. So these are just of a couple of examples of intervention we are trying to test and implement. It's also challenging in the product development side because this has to happen really fast.
Yeah.
And has to be really customer centered, user centered. And also has to hit the spot because otherwise you use human lives.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, such another different perspective on the COVID-19. Thank you very much, Teresa, very much for what you told us and for what you do. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Rajat. I hope to see you soon at your or my place in Maastricht to have a dinner together once again. And hopefully to have you both guest next time in my show.
We love that.
Thank you, guys.
Thank
bye.
You.
See you next time. Bye, Rajat.
See you.
Bye, Teresa. Bye, Noah. Your little Noah. He's sleepy. Is he sleeping?
He's finally sleeping.
Bye, guys. Thanks a lot. Bye. Okay, thank you to our guest. So we see each other next the second Monday of May. So it will be the 11th, I guess. And thanks to Radio Onda Italiana to have asked us. And bye to the next time.